I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
On a cool summer evening in 1994, 79-year-old cancer patient Ruth Loader will stand at the door of her remote Ohio farmhouse, bidding farewell to her daughter and son-in-law, who have just finished up mowing her lawn. She has plans in the morning to head to the local diner for breakfast with her sister. But for this evening, it's just her and her latest book. But then, Ruth hears a noise outside, so she sets down her book and opens her door to see what it is. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, before we begin, you never know, of course, we've talked about this, what we're talking about in a given day.
I never know what I'm talking about.
No.
No, I'm joking. I never know what you're going to talk about.
You never know what we're talking about here in the
right. I never know what I'm going to talk about here. Yes.
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 And yeah. So this case, I mean, I just to be clear before you and I began and before anyone listens, this one just emotionally just wrecked me.
Right. So this is how we started today. Yeah. Amy arrived and then immediately told me that she needs to get this case out of her head because it's taking a mental toll.
Yes.
And then I'm like, great. So that means you're going to put it into my head now.
Right.
And so we're about to share it with all of these people.
Yeah.
That are all going to be equally as haunted by this case as you, or not really, because we didn't do such a deep dive into the research.
No. I mean, I think it is. This one's pretty upsetting. And to be clear, it will get out of my head in sort of some way, but every single woman that we talk about here, I always feel like I carry them with me. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just all of these cases, all of these women, I'm constantly thinking about them. Any person that we've covered so far, I'm thinking about them. Cases that don't make it into the podcast, I'm thinking about them, by name and them specifically. And so this one, this is one of those ones where I'm oh, this one is just going to be hard to keep with me, is what I'm saying.
Okay. It's a heavier one.
It is. So we're just going to get right in, because there's a lot to cover here.
Okay.
On December 7th, 2001, Tom Gardner was led into a narrow room in the Callaway County Courthouse in Fulton, Missouri. Tom had traveled over 600 miles to be there for this moment. He would have just a few minutes to see if, after 7 years, he would finally learn the location of his mother-in-law's body. Inside the room was 30-year-old Elle. And as our policy, we're not using his name. Elle had aged a lot since the last time Tom had seen him in 1995. Back then, Elle had been standing trial in a different case. And back then, he hadn't shared information about Ruth Loader, Tom's mother-in-law, who had been missing since 1994. But here, in 2001, the two men sat across from each other, separated by a long table. The clock was ticking. Everyone was waiting for the judge to return with a sentencing announcement. The day before, Elle had been found guilty in the murders of William and Flossie Brewer, an elderly Missouri couple. The jury had recommended the death penalty, but likely no one sitting in the courtroom, least of all Elle, was anxious about what the judge would decide. After all, Elle was already on death row in Oklahoma for the murder of Roxy Riddell, and Oklahoma had asked for him to be sent back. No matter what Missouri decided in his fate, he would be going back to Oklahoma.
How many murders are you talking about right now?
Well, four.
Four? You're saying he's 30, although you're saying that he looked like he aged a lot.
Well, you know, because he was pretty young when these happened.
And so he was in his early 20s when he did these things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Tom's main purpose for being there that day, though, was to find out what happened to Ruth and where her body was. And he had just 20 minutes to find out before the court break was over. Everyone who knew Ruth Lucille Loader loved her. Born in Tuscarawas County, Ohio in 1915 to George and Dulcie Riedenbach, Ruth grew up in a large farming family and graduated in 1933 from Newcomers Town High School as the class valedictorian. By 1938, she married Fred Loader, and the two welcomed four children, Bonnie, Thomas, Kathy, and Ellen. And for clarity, Bonnie ends up marrying a Tom, and she has a brother named Tom, so I'm calling the brother Thomas for clarity here. But there's 19 years separating the oldest Bonnie from the youngest Ellen. The kids all grew up in an old farmhouse on 100 acres outside of town, surrounded by cornfields, a railroad track cutting along the back of the property. All the kids could remember times when men walking along or riding the rails would stop by their mother's porch, hoping for some food. They'd come to the door, and Ellen said, Mom didn't want to give them money because they might buy alcohol with it, but by God, she fed them with what she had on the counter. And every time someone stopped by, the kids could remember dashing inside to fix their own peanut butter sandwiches so they could eat with the men on the porch. Like many Midwestern families, Ruth had grown up poor, and the stigma attached to it was something that she carried with her for the rest of her life. Ruth and Fred worked hard to provide for their family, and for them, this meant that both of them took jobs outside of the home. At various times, Ruth worked for the deli department of the IGA, and she also worked at Bates Metal Products. Eventually, after her kids were grown, she worked and retired from General Electric in Port Washington. Tragedy would strike the family in 1982, though. A little over 1 month after their 44th wedding anniversary, Ruth lost her husband Fred in a car accident. Now, this loss deeply impacted the family, and even though three out of the four kids had moved away from their small town, they all reconvened, gathering around Ruth's kitchen table to mourn the loss of their father. In the coming decade, Ruth lived alone in the old farmhouse, and as a widow, developed her own routines. Practically every morning would find her down at the port truck stop having breakfast, usually in the company of her younger sister, Pearl. And in many ways, life sort of carried on for them, but then sometime around 1994, Ruth learned that she had colon cancer. Treatment was incredibly hard on her, already a tiny woman, the 5'2 Ruth. Her weight plummeted below 70 pounds. Eventually, she was hospitalized for removal of a malignant tumor on her colon. But even this didn't stop Ruth from maintaining her sense of humor. Even ill and hospitalized, she playfully flirted with her doctors, saying things like, I'm a red hot mama.
That's adorable.
That is, when they were asking her how she was feeling. By the point that she was discharged from the hospital, 79-year-old Ruth was still feisty, but frail. But she was determined to start feeling better, tracking the pathway back to a healthy weight on a chart that she pinned on her kitchen wall.
You already mentioned that the couple that he killed was elderly.
Mm-hmm.
She's getting up there.
Mm-hmm.
Is the other victim elderly also?
No, Roxy was in her 30s.
Okay.
So on Monday night, August 29th, Bonnie, Ruth's oldest daughter, and her husband Tom finished mowing her mother's lawn. Bonnie and her husband Tom lived pretty close to Ruth, so they were the ones who looked in on her regularly, taking care of things like the lawn and running errands for her. They finished up around 7:30 p.m. and headed home. When Bonnie left, Ruth was standing in the doorway. Ruth was in her pink and white striped nightgown, and though it was August, the night was pretty chilly, so she threw on her old brown sweater, wrapping it around herself as she stood in her doorway to say goodbye. We'll see you tomorrow, Mom. Have a good time with Aunt Pearl, Bonnie remembered calling out as they left. Pearl was set to pick up Ruth in the morning so they could head to the port truck stop for breakfast. Ruth still owned her 1980 Buick Skylark, but since her surgery and cancer treatments, she'd relied on other people like her sister to help her get around for the past 4 months. Ruth was starting to feel well enough, though, that she was thinking about hoping to try out driving again the next day. The next morning, Pearl arrived at 7:50 a.m. and waited for her sister. Pearl was surprised to see that her sister's car wasn't in the driveway. And when Ruth didn't come out of her house, Pearl tried knocking and calling out to her. Still, Ruth didn't come to the door. Fearing something might be wrong, Pearl drove to Bonnie and Tom's house. Now, Tom was a retired police officer, so he went to check out the house first. Like Pearl, Tom didn't get an answer, so he circled around the back of the house. That's where he found the back door kicked in, the framing splintered across the floor. From inside, he could hear Ruth's alarm clock going off, set for 6:45 a.m., like it always was. When Tuscarawas police were called, they were already dealing with a separate missing persons report. 16-year-old E was missing from his father and stepmother's house, and with him, his father's .22 caliber pistol.
Okay, so this kid is missing. But why are we calling him by his initial? I know the other guy is L.
Yeah, so there's two here for clarity. And I am using E. He's a completely different person, and I am using his initial for a reason. So
wait, completely different? Like they're not, they don't know each other or?
They do know each other.
Oh, they do know each other.
Two separate people.
Two separate people. Okay. Yeah.
So for clarity, so we know who we're talking about here, E is a 16-year-old, and earlier that summer, he'd gotten into a little bit of trouble for participating in a break-in at a local bowling alley, Cy Young Lanes. During this break-in, about $30 in change had been taken from a vending machine, and some liquor was missing. Overall, though, he hadn't gotten in much trouble before. He was certainly thought of as, like, a lonely kid who didn't have any friends, and people would see him biking around town on his own, and he'd recently been working at a grocery store where he bagged groceries. But that Tuesday morning, E was nowhere to be found. Police didn't initially put these two disappearances together, but things actually come together relatively quickly. As soon as news breaks about Ruth's disappearance, a report comes in from a local person who knew Ruth and recognized her car. This woman said that she'd seen Ruth's car around 9 to 10 p.m. on Monday night and was actually just really surprised to see it. Ruth, after all, hadn't been driving in a while, so seeing the car at night had to have been startling. This is one of those towns where everyone knows.
Everybody's business. Yeah.
But what was even more surprising is that it wasn't Ruth driving the car, but a man with long, dark hair. So she kind of vowed to ask Ruth about it the next time she saw her. But when reports of Ruth missing reached her, she knew immediately that what she had seen was important. So with her help, police were able to identify the driver as 22-year-old L.
Okay.
Now, L was not a local. He was born in Oklahoma and had first entered into the juvenile justice system by the age of 10 for breaking and entering. Not long after, he was sent to foster care for car theft. By the time he reached adulthood, he hitchhiked from Oklahoma to Ohio, ending up at a craft fair where he met a woman named Susan. And in 1992, shortly after the birth of their son, the two were married. Now, things were not great between the two of them from the start. They were living in a travel trailer parked in an alley of Susan's hometown of Newcomerstown. Susan would later say that he often raped her, and that he didn't know the word no. But his abuse wasn't just directed at her. He was often angry at their son for crying. And in one instance, he took their 3-month-old outside when the baby's cries interrupted the movie that he was trying to watch. There, he started screaming at his infant to stop crying or else he would throw him against the trailer. Yeah. And then he shook his son so hard that he damaged tendons in the kid's limbs. And then, inexplicably, he bit his son so hard on the stomach that the boy bled.
So he's really, really a disturbed person. Also, yes. Is he still a teenager at this point?
So, yeah, so he's, you know, late teens.
When he gets married and has this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what ends up happening, what gets him some prison time as an adult, because he actually has like a juvenile record, but as an adult, he actually like steals a boat that he took on a joyride down the Tuscarawas River, and that gets him jail time. But by August 15th, 1994, though, he got out of jail after serving an 18-month sentence.
Jeez. So his wife and baby had a bit of a break. Does he go back to them, or?
At this point, they're estranged.
Okay.
Yeah. So it might seem like an odd pairing, like this lonely 16-year-old E, and then you have L, who's a 22-year-old father with a record. But the two seem to click. This wasn't surprising to Susan, who again is now estranged from him. She said L would often hang out with teenagers, preferring their company because they tended to be more impressed with him than the adults were.
Okay.
Yeah. And like E, L was now missing from the small town of Newcomerstown. Now, police were likely putting two and two together here relatively quickly. A search of Ruth's home had yielded a few clues. Ruth was a fan of romance and adventure novels, and her latest book seemed to have been set down, and her glasses that she needed for reading were not far away. Given this, they thought it was possible that she had disappeared earlier in the evening, likely not long after Bonnie and Tom left. Also missing from her home was a telephone cord and about $40 in cash. Missing as well were her guns. She'd kept them handy after a break-in in her home 5 years before. But prior to that, her kids remembered her picking off groundhogs that appeared in her backyard. A regular Annie Oakley, they'd say. But what was unsettling to all the family members as they converged at Ruth's home once again was that her cancer and heart medications were still in the house. Two of Ruth's daughters were nurses and knew that without those medications, Ruth's life hung in the balance. Her daughter Ellen said, "I knew she was in a weakened condition. She wouldn't live long without her heart medication. 2 to 3 days." An all-out search was launched for Ruth, with teams of friends, family, police, and FBI combing the county looking for her. Time was of the essence. And then they got the call. On September 1st, 2 days after she was reported missing, Ruth's dusty red Buick Skylark had been found about 50 feet into a farmer's field on County Road 147 in Kingdom City, Missouri, a good 650 miles away from Ruth's farmhouse in Ohio. The farmer who owned that field, Frank Watson, had found Ruth's car in his hayfield that Wednesday afternoon. Given that he was states away from where Ruth went missing, he didn't know about her, but he could see that whoever had driven the car had driven through the field and done some circles before apparently came to a stop, stuck in the mud. He said that everything had been emptied out of the car and scattered on the ground. When police arrived, they ran the Ohio plates and realized it belonged to Ruth Loader. A search of the vehicle showed that there weren't any signs of a struggle or violence, but the car looked like it had been run hard, and according to an investigator, it was smoking. A search of the fields around the car proved fruitless. Ruth wasn't there. Now, Frank Watson, the farmer, lived just down the road from the Brewers, William and Flossie. He'd known them since the 1970s when he bought his farm, and he knew them pretty well. In fact, the spot he found Ruth's car was just 150 feet from the Brewer's house. That's why Frank knew the couple's routines so well. William, at 86, had been using assistive devices like canes to get around, and Frank noticed that the Brewer's car wasn't in its usual spot. Frank said he always parked his car right in front of the house so he wouldn't have to walk so far. But then the next day, that would have been the Thursday, but then the next day the car was gone again, and we kind of wondered about things then. My wife told me that somebody should go check on the Brewers.
And they're the couple you mentioned at the beginning?
Yeah. That somebody ends up being William and Flossie's son and grandson. Family members had already been trying to get a hold of the elderly couple on the phone before then, but without success. When they arrived, they had to use a flashlight to go down into the basement. That's where they found the couple. They'd been shot 3 times in the head, and their bodies rested where they'd fallen, draped over their wood pile. Flossie had a phone cord wrapped around her neck. Between them, their small dog, described as a poodle mix, waited, still alive. Steve, the grandson, said that upon seeing his grandparents like that, particularly Flossie, he fled the basement.
So these two are in their 80s?
Flossie's in her late 70s, and yeah, William was in his 80s.
Jeez. So I'm finding this funny so far. Not funny, haha, but just strange that we have their bodies. Like, he just killed them and left them. But Ruth is gone?
Ruth is, yeah.
I don't know. That seems so strange.
Yeah. I mean, because often when we talk about, like, things like, you know, multiple killings, like, there's, like, this concept of a MO, right? Like,
right.
Yeah. But Ruth is missing, and these two, they're very kind of feel like different circumstances.
Right.
Now, police in Ohio and Missouri knew that they had something bigger on their hands, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the term spree killer wasn't officially used by the FBI until 1992. And by 1994, when Ruth disappeared and the Brewers were murdered, it wasn't exactly in common usage. Now, Americans were already familiar with the term serial killer, but this wasn't exactly that. Serial killers had what is referred to as a cooling off period or a gap of time between killings. And the quick succession of these crimes didn't fit that profile. Despite lacking the terminology, police likely knew that the perpetrators of these crimes needed to be caught quickly before they struck again. When the news of the Brewers being murdered reached Ruth's family, it's likely that they realized the possibility of her being found alive was slim. It had already been 3 days without access to her medications, and her car was found at the scene of a double homicide. Well, like the newspapers at the time tried to soften it by saying these crimes might be connected, but it's clear they were, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, there was still a full-scale search that included ground and air searches, but hope was in short supply. By September 3rd, the sheriff's office in Tuscarawas County officially filed arrest warrants against L and E for burglary and kidnapping. The FBI followed the next day, filing federal warrants against the two, charging them with unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Now, because at this point, L and E's associates back in Newcomerstown were talking, and what they had to say wasn't good. Back in Newcomerstown, the kids were saying that E had wanted to leave Newcomerstown, a town that he thought had nothing to do. And L had talked about looking for a car to steal and that he planned to go out like Jesse James. Everything pointed to the idea that there was more to come, but E's family remained steadfast in their support of him. Now, this is the 16-year-old, right?
Right.
Yeah. Like, in the papers, his father begged E to return himself in, like, for sure, right? Mm-hmm. But it was his belief and E's stepmother's belief that E could be in danger himself, perhaps even held hostage by L. Police knew the two were likely in the Brewer's car, which was an Oldsmobile Cutlass, since that was missing from their home, but that was just, like, the only lead that they were really working from.
I think, not only as a parent, but as anybody, it's hard to believe that somebody who's 16 would be capable of doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the parents, like, trying to support him, trying to think, like, give him the benefit of the doubt on this.
Right.
Are they the youngest we've covered?
In terms of perpetrators?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like we've had others in their, like low 20s, but I don't think we've ever talked about a teenager committing these crimes.
Right. So, like, just the fact that there's a 16-year-old being sought.
Right.
And, yeah, so his parents, like, you know, essentially they're processing this. Like, to them, L is older, right?
Not much, but, yeah, he's definitely older.
Like, I mean, he's essentially at this point, you know, he's not much older, but he's an adult with a kid.
Right.
And also he already has this, like, built-in criminal history.
Mm-hmm.
E, on the other hand, he's 16. The most he's gotten in trouble for is, like, this, like, break-in,
mm-hmm.
right, at the bowling alley, which, of course, would have been upsetting, but it's not, like...
Well, it's $30 and, like, a break-in somewhere. It's typical kid stuff.
Right.
Like, if a kid is going that way, you know?
But, yeah.
But this isn't.
This is something else. So,
right.
To them, like, it makes sense to be, like, maybe he's been kidnapped, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, essentially, a new report comes in. 37-year-old Roxy Ruddle was found near the north side of Lake Stanley Draper in Oklahoma City. She had been shot to death. Now, Roxy had found herself in the Lake Stanley Draper area because she couldn't sleep. Roxy had spent most of her life doing labor in male-dominated fields like truck driving. In fact, that's where she met her husband of 2 years, and the two often worked together as driver and co-driver. The two were living with her husband's mother, and they were saving up to get a place of their own. But Roxy's biggest dream was having her own ranch filled with animals. She actually owned 20 horses already, having paid for them with her trucking income and boarding them at a nearby facility. and she took in every stray cat and dog she found, adopting them out only when she was sure their adopters would care for them in the same way that she would. So it's with these goals in mind that Roxy had gotten a second job less than a month before working security at Lake Stanley Draper. Now, Roxy, in her work life, often worked night shifts, and that schedule is hard to, like, adjust to. So when she couldn't sleep after work on Saturday, September 3rd, she grabbed her fishing gear and headed back to the lake. He was just 15 minutes drive away. But Roxy wouldn't make it home. James Hale and his friends were out on dirt bikes that Sunday when James caught glimpse of something off the path as they passed by. He wanted to stop to try to get a better look, but his friend didn't want to. "Oh, that's just something left over from last Halloween," the friend said. James, though, disagreed, and the two couldn't turn their dirt bikes around because the trail was so narrow, so they went forward, planning to backtrack once they could turn around at the ranger station. Instead, they found the trail blocked by a car. Later, the authorities would inform them that the car belonged to William and Flossie Brewer, who had just been murdered in Missouri, and that what they'd seen off the trail wasn't a Halloween decoration. It was Roxy. Missing from the area was Roxy's 1991 silver and gray pickup truck.
Now, I feel like there was another story that we've covered before where somebody thought it was a Halloween decoration, too.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be such a strange thing that people are just like, oh, yeah, that's just a Halloween decoration, and then it's absolutely it's not.
Yeah, so I think it's just, like, it's hard for the brain to process
that,
like, this horrific thing could be.
Right. It's just, it puts people in such, like, an innocent place where they're just like, oh, it's just a Halloween, Halloween decoration.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. Now, we're now at mid-afternoon on Monday, September 5th, and that's when two people stop outside a remote house in New Mexico, about 15 miles away from Santa Fe. The two got out of the pickup truck that they were in and asked the homeowner if they could have some gas and maybe some money. The male homeowner gave them a few gallons while his wife watched from inside the home. She thought the two of them seemed suspicious, and they seemed to be sizing up some other men who were working nearby, but they left without incident. Still the next day, the man shared this incident with his boss. That means the encounter must have seemed, like, strange enough to warrant a mention. And that's when his boss showed him that morning's paper about E and L, who were wanted in a cross-country killing spree.
Were they the same? Was it pictures of them?
Yes. So there had been pictures run. So, like, he's like, oh.
It was them?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he calls this in, right? Now, around the same time, the police are fielding a call from another man. He'd picked up two guys hitchhiking on New Mexico 599, which is a bypass road around Santa Fe. He drove them into town, and the two of them on the way told them that their pickup truck was stuck in a ravine. So he stopped and got them after they were done doing their errands and brought them back to the bypass around 7:30 p.m. He, too, upon reading the newspaper the next morning, realized just who exactly he'd had in his truck the night before. Using these reports, authorities did a helicopter search of the area, spotting Roxy's silver Dodge stuck in a ditch in the high desert. And 3 miles away from that, they spotted signs of E and L. By 9:20 a.m., 8 New Mexico state troopers moved in on the site. Asleep in a culvert were E and L. Now, authorities had believed that the two of them were primarily moving at night and sleeping during the day, and this confirmed that. This gave the state troopers the element of surprise, which was a good thing because a Marlin rifle was positioned between the two of them. Nearby was another rifle, a BB gun, the .22 caliber that E had taken from his father's home. And woken from sleep, the two were told to stay on their knees and raise their hands. This is a command that E complied with, although he tried to run but was quickly apprehended. Now, it ends up being this officer named Daniel Becker who ends up speaking primarily with L after the arrest. L was advised of his Miranda rights, but he still seemed to want to talk. Well, initially, at least. When Officer Becker asked him specifically about what happened in Ohio, though, he asked to go on to the next question. When he asked him about Missouri, he said he didn't remember being there. Becker pressed him a bit more about Missouri, and he finally said that there were several weapons that were recovered in New Mexico that would match the bullets at the scene in Missouri. And then when he was asked about the murders in Missouri, and if he was fully responsible, he just said it was a 50-50 deal between him and E. Finally, he said that he and E had come from Ohio in a red vehicle, and that when it got stuck in the mud, they devised a plan to go to the Brewer's house to ask if they could use the phone to call a wrecker service. Elle said that they were greeted at the door by Flossie and that they could see William inside, sitting on the couch. He said once inside, they talked to the couple for a bit, and once they realized there was no phone book in the house, they decided they were going to kill the couple. Now, honestly, again, I say this practically every time we hear from a perpetrator, Elle gets to shape this story, right? So, but I don't believe for a second they planned on calling a tow when they had a stolen car. And I also don't believe for a second that a rural farm couple in 1994 didn't have a phone book.
Right. Both things seem highly unlikely.
Right.
We'll be back in a moment.
Now, Elle claims that they tied up Flossie's hands behind her back with a phone cord and then led the couple down the stairs to the cellar. He said neither fought, though at one point he did say that Flossie tried to push the gun away. Now, here Elle claims that it was E who killed the couple, shooting Flossie first.
Do we believe this?
Yeah, well, no. No. Yeah, so reports vary. So, for instance, like, you know, earlier I said, like, the phone cord had been around Flossie's neck, right? And he's saying we would put it around her hands, right? And also there's, like, different versions of the story. Like, in some, he was upstairs when this shooting happened. And others, he claimed to have seen them fall onto the wood pile after being shot. So it's just, yeah, this is his versions, right?
Right. I don't know why it was, because when they found her, it was around her neck, right?
Yeah, so that's what the newspaper reports were saying.
Okay, yeah. So we don't know if that's 100% true.
Well, you know, there can always be errors in that regard.
But of course he's going to blame the kid.
Right, yeah. Now, he says that they went upstairs and that while he pet the Brewer's dog, E rummaged around the house looking for weapons and the keys to the car.
Okay, so really E is the mastermind here.
That's what he's saying in this situation with the Brewers. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think.
I mean, maybe E is rummaging around looking for things, but it feels like this would have been done on, like, Al's instruction.
Right. I mean, it's easy, I think, well, not easy, but it's the tendency would be here to see Elle as the aggressor in
right
the
do I just yeah is that true, or do I just want E to be more innocent in this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the tendency, like, right, like, particularly, oh my goodness, seeing like the 16-year-old boy's photos, right? And he's just got this like long curly blonde locks of hair. Well,
it's just, it's like a little like a young,
he's got a baby guy, face, right? Too, yeah. And it's just, it's hard to really reconcile with a 16-year-old participating and being active in participating in these types of crimes. But, like, yeah, I don't think, honestly, each doesn't get a pass
right
in this. He, I believe, is an active participant.
Right. It's just hard to wrap your head around, I guess. Yeah. You want to believe that somebody that age is good, right, for the most part. So
yeah. Now, you know, despite all these changes in his story, though, like, it is clear that Elle is acknowledging, at least at this point, participation in these crimes, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what really follows next for the pair is that there's a fight for which state will get them first, right? Like, they're in New Mexico, but the crimes have been committed in Oklahoma, Missouri, and Ohio, and all of those states want them back. And this is actually where some legal maneuvering takes place. All three states have the death penalty, but Oklahoma's laws are perhaps the worst for 16-year-old E. Not only could he be tried as an adult in Oklahoma, but also Oklahoma had no restrictions on age for the death penalty. Which means if E, if convicted for his role in the death of Roxy, he could be put to death. Now, both E and L, they wanted to go back to Ohio first. So their lawyers are fighting for them to be sent back to Ohio. They weren't up for murder charges there, and the state of Ohio wouldn't put E on death row because they had these restrictions, these age restrictions. But in actually a pretty bold move, Ohio dropped the charges for Ruth's kidnapping, essentially taking themselves out of the running and prioritizing and hurrying along the death penalty cases in the other states. Eventually, it actually will be Oklahoma that will win out, and L and E will be extradited to Oklahoma.
Was that kind of, like, we know that Ohio mm-hmm. kind of shaped this. Do you think that, like, Missouri went along with it to kind of, like, shove it into Oklahoma because they knew it would be harsher there?
Yeah, I think so. So, like, the lawyers for both of them, particularly E's lawyer, were pretty angry with the way that played out.
Right. It seems very deliberate.
Yeah. So there was some talk about Ohio's specific maneuvers, right? But mm-hmm. yeah, so like they want them to go to Oklahoma first because of the laws that were in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But back in Ohio, though, these arrests brought little solace to the Loder family. Like, they still had no idea where Ruth was. Mm-hmm. Sitting on a swing beneath the buckeye tree in Ruth's backyard, her son Thomas said, "I just want to find her and put her in the ground." And her daughter Ellen told reporters, "Oh God, help us find her so we can put her to rest." The family seemed to have largely resolved at this point that Ruth was no longer alive.
But they know even if it wasn't violence, her medications.
Right. So without her medications, without proper care, given her frail mm-hmm. state, yeah.
They know.
Yeah, they knew. Now, down at the port truck stop, the cafe that Ruth ate at, a waitress said, "I can't tell you how empty this place feels without her. I just can't believe we lost her after we fought so hard to get her back." And then she added, "She was our matriarch. She came in here and joked and smiled and laughed and brightened everyone's day. That's just the way she was. Everyone in town knew her, partly because she was here for all of her 79 years, and partly because she was so easy to love." By September 8th, authorities said that they had information from the New Mexico State Police that Ruth's body was in Tuscarawas County area. But despite this, by the next day, the FBI announced that they would be scaling back their search, and the official search party was reduced to 30. 4 days after that, the official search ends completely. Authorities felt like they'd covered all the areas they thought her body might be. While the family awaited for news about what would happen with L and E, they began packing up the farmhouse. Ruth's son, Thomas, a teacher who lived 120 miles round trip away, starts talking about wanting to move there. It's a way for him to feel close to his mom and to also keep the old farmhouse in the family. By January of the next year, Thomas retired early from teaching, saying it was kind of nice to be away from the stress of teaching teenagers. He wanted to move his young family to the farm, and he wanted to spend the spring, summer, and fall of 1995 searching for his mother in the nearby fields. He's overruled, though. His family didn't want to move to the rural area he grew up with, and the family was facing having to sell the farm. Meanwhile, Bonnie said that every time she went to go get ice cream at the local stand, she had to pass her mother's home, and she thought of the possibility of her being out there, somewhere in the fields. Ellen said that she kept looking to the skies because someone told her that a gathering of buzzards could be for her mother's body. Eventually, the siblings would be forced to sue their mother for control of the property. Without her body, without a death certificate, it was the only way for them to gain control of her estate and to prepare the house for sale. Now, Al was the first to stand trial in November of 1995 in Oklahoma on first-degree murder charges in the murder of Roxy. Most of Ruth's family wanted to be there for the trial, hoping to find some scrap of information about Ruth's disappearance during the proceedings. And some information had already been released in a pretrial meeting earlier in May. Officer Daniel Becker had come from New Mexico and testified that during his time with Elle, Elle did confess to murdering Ruth. He was not allowed to testify about statements that E had made, though. Neither, he said, had made a statement about where her body could be located. During Elle's official trial about the murder of Roxy, though, a tape is played of Officer Becker questioning Elle. He asks if Elle killed Roxy, and he said he thinks he did. Becker then testified that Elle told him the specifics of Ruth's murder during that part of the interview that was not recorded. Elle was found guilty of Roxy's murder. During the sentencing phase, his attorneys brought in his mother and sister, who testified about Elle's experiences in childhood, which included the abuse he suffered from all three of his mother's husbands, his learning difficulties, and the poverty he experienced in childhood.
So what are they using that for? Just saying that because he had a tough life, he chose to murder people?
Well, so basically, there's this chance, they're there for character witnesses, right? And kind of framing his experiences is also a way for them to try to, like, not have him get the death penalty.
Right. Right.
They're hoping for some leniency there. This is not leniency that the judge ultimately decides to go for. But some of Ruth's family, though, was there for this. And Thomas, her son, he wanted to be there because he hoped he could give some sort of victim impact statement or question where his mother was. But because Elle wasn't on trial for Ruth's disappearance or likely murder, that wasn't possible. Instead, in the courtroom, Ruth's daughter, Bonnie, and her husband, Tom, listened on, and actually this experience fundamentally changed how they saw Elle. They understood in some ways how brutal Elle's upbringing had been.
Really? So it did change them a little bit? It's funny because, like, a lot of people are abused.
Yeah.
A lot, but not a lot of people are murderers.
Right. So, I mean, this is, like, one of those instances. I mean, I think, like, I've always made clear, like, I'm anti-death penalty, right?
Right.
Ruth's family is not. Okay. Like, ultimately, they believe that, yes, he should get the death penalty. And even Bonnie and Tom, right? But it still changed how they viewed the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah, I've not had that experience, so it's not for me to say how they should feel about it. But,
I'm not saying how they should feel about it. I'm just saying that it's like, it is one of those things. Definitely, I think abuse and things like that can lead somebody down the wrong path.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying that there are so many people that are abused and don't go this way either. So it's just, it's one of those things, like, it's hard to, and not in relation to the death penalty, but just, mm-hmm. like, in relation to things people do.
Like what, like, he went on to do. Right.
Can we have compassion but still not forgive somebody? Yes. Right? Like.
Right. So, yeah, this is one of those situations where, like, her,
it can change kind of how you view it, but he mm-hmm. still did those things.
He still did those things. So they still believe personally that he should have gotten the death penalty. And he is given the death penalty in Roxy's case. But it did kind of change the scope of how they interacted with the situation.
Just because they're good people.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It's almost like, I don't want to say manipulative at that point, but it changes how you think about it, but not always.
Right.
I don't know. I have a hard time with this because I'm like, I do like to, when somebody does something milder, I'm like, okay, well, they're acting out because they mm-hmm. have been through a lot.
But when it's elevated.
But when it's this far, clearly you know right from wrong at this point. This isn't, you know, blowing off steam. This is murder.
Yeah. And, like, you know,
it's multiple. It's not like one accidental thing because something went too far. This is deliberate murder.
Yeah. And, like, honestly, when I see things like Elle, right, and I think about, like, what justice is and what the justice system is, like, I am probably, like, quite fringe in my, like, belief system about, like, the justice system. But, like, I think, like, okay, if we don't want things like this to happen in the future, right, like, how do we change that, right?
Right.
Like, this kid, from the start, like, he's 10 years old and, like, already knows law enforcement.
Right. Right. I mean, and then he's this young father who's raping his wife.
Yeah.
And biting his baby.
Yeah. There were, There were red flags
right
all the way through.
So did it have to get to this point? Is that what you're saying? Like, so at what point could we have intervened?
Yeah, what kind of interventions could have happened when he was experiencing abuse, when he was experiencing right. poverty, when he was experiencing all those things?
Well, and I firmly believe that, too. Like, had he gotten the right therapy, medication, adults in his life.
Yeah. How might it never have gotten to the point where even, you know, when we get to the point of him, like, abusing his wife, right? Like, right. how do we even prevent all of that stuff from happening, right?
Right. And yeah. I think that firmly falls on the way the adults surrounding the mm-hmm. situation respond to the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think this is like
I see what you're saying. Yeah. Though. Now, like, it's not so much what he did at this point. It's what happened to get him there. Like, what right. or what didn't happen to get what him didn't there.
Happen. Yeah. Now, E's trial, though, the 16-year-old, like, this is different.
Yeah. I'm still having a hard time with the 16-year-old.
Yeah.
It's which, like almost in the age range of my kids. It's a little younger than mm-hmm. my kids. And you know how much I love them and all of their friends. You know, I right. love this age group so much because they're like just coming into their own and mm-hmm. finding out who they are. And then now we've got this kid who you've already described to me as having this little curly blonde hair. And,
yeah.
you know,
it's hard. And this
having
is
a hard time with him.
This is his trial, though, takes place in May 1996. So we're well out. He's like, what, 18?
Yeah. Still point. A baby.
He's still a baby. But so during his case, things are different. Like, Ruth's kidnapping could not be mentioned during the trial, right? Likely because they dropped those charges, right? Mm-hmm. But unlike Elle's case, though, the jury deliberated for 14 hours trying to determine his guilt or innocence because they too were wrestling.
Okay.
With this. And during this time, they came back to the judge twice and they were deadlocked. They could not agree. So it was an 11-1 deadlock situation, mm-hmm. and the one was not budging. So this trial ended in a hung jury. Now, when a trial ends in a hung jury, they have to retry it. Mm-hmm. And a new trial was scheduled for October. But moments before the jury selection was to take place, E pleaded guilty to Roxy's murder. Previously, it had been made clear that no plea agreement would happen unless E would talk about what happened to Ruth. And in a written statement, E said that he would cooperate with authorities in Ohio in their search for Ruth. Now, even from the start, locals and Ruth's family had their doubts about the usefulness of E's help. Local Florine Lawrence said, "I don't think we hold out much hope that kid is going to be honest." And really, others shared that sentiment. In the fall, E was quietly brought back to his hometown. Ruth's family was not informed of his presence in the area. E claimed that he didn't know where Ruth was, but instead showed investigators various areas around the county. He said that when he and Al used to drive around together, Al would point to various locations and claim that these were good places to hide a body. Subsequent searches of those locations that E indicated, again, proved fruitless. In 2001, Al was once again in court, this time facing the murder charges in the murders of William and Flossie in Missouri. And that's where Tom, Ruth's son-in-law, purposely drove to, hoping at long last to find out answers to where Ruth was. Now, by this point, Al had already been on death row for 6 years. It had been 7 years since he participated in the kidnapping of Ruth, and Tom was right. After all this time, he was ready to talk. But he had just minutes with Al before the court recess ended. Al needed to talk, and he needed to do it quickly. On the night Ruth was kidnapped, Al said that he and E decided it was time to get out of town. They set out on foot from Newcomers Town looking for a car to steal. They followed the railroad tracks for miles until they came to a small farmhouse outside of town, a red Buick sitting outside a garage. The two started looking around for some keys when Ruth came outside, startled by the sound. Given the evidence, Ruth must have made her way back inside, and the two kicked in the door to come after her. Al would tell Tom that there was some short fighting between them all, and that he and E ended up tying her up with a red phone cord. From there, they put her in the trunk of her own car. Elle said that that night, he and E crisscrossed the back roads of Tuscarawas County with Ruth in the trunk, stopping along a guardrail. When they got Ruth out of the trunk, Ruth said to them, "You might as well kill me because I have cancer." And they did, shooting Ruth 3 times in the head. Elle said they threw her body over the guardrail, leaving her there. Now, in that narrow Missouri courthouse room, Elle said that he would try to draw a map the best he could to help them find Ruth's body. And though he did, a later search of that area didn't turn up Ruth's body. Elle's map was wrong. Elle was sentenced to death for the murders of William and Flossie, but sent back to await execution for Roxy's death. In his meeting with Tom, Elle had asked for forgiveness in Ruth's murder. Tom said he thought back to learning of Elle's childhood during the trial for Roxy's murder, and he thought, how could I not forgive him?
Tom is just, he's just so good.
Yeah.
He has clearly a very big heart.
Yeah, I mean, this is where it's like,
it's hard, right? And also maybe for Tom and Bonnie, maybe it's easier for them to like do that, just to process.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is one of those things, it's like, unless you're in it,
right,
you don't know where
right
you're going to end up, right? Now, Elle did stay in touch with Bonnie and Tom, sending them letters about how he had found God. The last one was a photograph with a Bible inscription that he sent 1 month before his execution. On July 1st, 2003, at 8:11 p.m., Elle was pronounced dead after receiving a lethal injection at Oklahoma State Penitentiary. He was the 860th person executed in the United States since 1976, and the 693rd person to be executed by lethal injection. E remains in prison, sentenced to life.
I feel like, though, Tom saying that, like forgiving him,
mm-hmm.
considering that this young man ended up dying,
yeah,
was probably actually the healthiest thing for him.
Yeah.
At that point, how do you carry that much anger into something?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we're ending a horrific story with a horrific story. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing good in it. There's no good here. There's no good. It's not resolved in a way that anyone can get past in a smooth way,
mm-hmm.
for their own mental health.
Yeah.
So, especially, I don't know, like, there's a few things. What would have happened had Ruth not come out of the house that night? Not blaming Ruth at all, but just, like, had she slept through that, what would have happened? Would they have, they wouldn't have killed her? And would they have killed other people after? Like, all of these things are, like, so interconnected, and, like, one thing changes another, right?
Right.
So,
I mean,
I don't know.
I think,
like, were they actually,
yeah,
so at just that point, just like in this thing, were they just,
they were. So it's hard. And I don't think Elle, because Elle is really the most talkative of the two.
Right.
I don't think even he quite understands why. And at one point he said, like, you just don't understand how crazy we were at that point. Like, I think they were kind of like egging each other on.
Was there substances involved? Did they ever say that? Or
they didn't say that. I think it's just like they were kind of locked in this like idea together.
Right.
Right.
But I wonder if once they did kill Ruth, if they thought, oh, there's no coming back from this now, we might as well just keep going.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, they,
it's such a wild turn of events.
Yeah, I don't want to leave too much space to talk about their intention, but it is important to know, like, this is, they were intentionally seeking out violence and to harm people. This was not something I wasn't going to mention because I don't really want to leave a lot of space for this. And we don't often talk about, like,
right. But it was intentional. They weren't just,
it was intentional. In fact, Elle specifically states that he wants to harm and kill people who are LGBTQ.
He said that during, like, the trial?
So, yeah. So, during the course of the investigation, he says that was the intent of him and E, was to drive to California and harm people who are gay.
So, they stole the car to go do this?
Yes.
Okay. So, that really changes how I feel with some of, like, the sympathy. earlier, especially in regards to like their ages and everything. So I know that that's not something you wanted to share because you didn't want to give them too much space or talk about them too much. But I'm kind of glad you did share that with us because I think that really changes how I see them.
Right. And I didn't really want to share that either because it's just like there's so much harm and intentional harm done to people who are LGBTQ. It's just that does.
Especially given like where we are right now as a country, I feel like it's important to know that. And I know people in that community know it and feel it, but it's important to know that like there's a certain amount of violence and harm like actually directed constantly. And this goes back to obviously forever.
Yeah. So like this is, you know, when we're talking about like what happened when Ruth comes to the door, like how, because this is not like a snowball situation, this where they like got into something and didn't know how to get out. Like there was intentionality.
Right. With what they were doing. Yeah. She wasn't their like their target victim, but who knows the difference at that point, right? She got in the way of them getting to their actual targets.
Right. And like essentially they end up saying like, you know, they just feel like they can't be identified if the person whose car they stole is dead. Oof. So it's just like this is those murders are a means to an end for them, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So there's intentionality here. There's a thought process here. And we can go back to Elle's statement about wanting to go out like Jesse James, right? Like they both had intention to harm people.
Ugh. Okay. So I guess we'll head back into the rest of the story.
Now, so we're talking more about like Ruth's family members and like they all came to different places in thinking about her disappearance and the need to find her. Like they had a memorial that was held on the one year anniversary of her disappearance. Now, this was something that her son Thomas didn't support at the time. He said, "You can't have a funeral or memorial service without a body. I'm sorry. My sisters know how I feel about it. I lay down to sleep and I see Mom standing there by the hearth, dressed in that skimpy nightgown and no shoes, hands tied with the phone cord and a gun to her head." For Bonnie, she hoped that the memorial would offer some solace, but found it didn't. She said, "It's still with you every day, a never-ending nightmare. We may not talk about it much anymore, but the four of us know how it feels. It's still in our minds and in our hearts." It's now been over 30 years since Ruth was kidnapped and murdered. Thomas, Ruth's son, is no longer alive. Her grandchildren are parents now, and her name is etched on a headstone next to her husband's name at the cemetery. But Ruth is still missing. About the search for her mother, Ellen said a few years ago, "I've come to realize it's not her anymore. She's in heaven with my dad and my brother, sitting next to Elle, forgiving him." But in the same interview, her brother-in-law Tom said that he holds out hope that someone will come forward to tell him where Ruth is so that he can bury her. His hope is that E will say something, or that someone E or Elle spoke to would have more information. And for what it's worth, that's actually my hope too. Now, this was a hard story to tell, but I hope you'll consider sharing this story. Not to highlight what E and L did, which was tearing apart so many families, but in remembrance of Ruth, William, Flossie, and Roxy.
Ohio summer. Ruth Loader, 79. Missing since August 29th, 1994. From Port Washington, Ohio. You can spend a lifetime watching corn transform the land. Year after year, the horizon disappears, knee high by the 4th of July, as high as an elephant's eye. Every farm kid knows how to measure this way. You can be a world away and still remember how the steady rows flicker when you drive by too fast. This morning I watched a herd of deer pick their way across the corn-stubbled fields, while nearby one of their own lay dead on the road's shoulder. beside me, my daughter, gasped. I know, I said. Instead of thinking of the doe, her last breath coming too soon, I was somewhere in Ohio, beside a 100-year-old farmhouse that creaks with the wind so often that it feels like every generation it has sheltered still lives inside. I thought of the small reading light, fighting back that growing August dark, and the delicious chill of the evening air. For a second, I could hear them again, too, their voices rasping, like the spent stalks, just as a woman, now all these years gone, closed her book and got up to see.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.